the short distance between us jangling with unspoken recriminations. "Clark," he would begin. "Don't," I would cut him off. "I don't want to talk to you." I surprised myself with how cold I could be. I certainly surprised the air stewardesses. I saw them on the flight, muttering between themselves at the way I turned rigidly away from Will, plugging my earphones in or resolutely staring out of the window. For once, he didn't get angry. That was almost the worst of it. He didn't get angry, and he didn't get sarcastic, and he simply grew quieter until he barely spoke. It was left to poor Nathan to bounce the conversation along, to ask questions about tea or coffee or spare packets of dry roasted peanuts, or whether anyone minded if he climbed past us to go to the loo. It probably sounds childish now, but it was not just a matter of pride. I couldn't bear it. I couldn't bear the thought that I would lose him. That he was so stubborn and determined not to see what was good, what could be good, that he would not change his mind. I couldn't believe that he would stick to that one date as if it were cast in stone. A million silent arguments rattled around my head. "Why is this not enough for you? Why am I not enough for you? Why could you not have confided in me? If we'd had more time, would this have been different?" Every now and then I would catch myself staring down at his tanned hands, those squared-off fingers, just inches from my own, and I would remember how our fingers felt entwined, the warmth of him, the illusion, even in stillness, of a kind of strength, and a lump would rise in my throat until I thought I could barely breathe, and I had to retreat to the WC, where I would lean over the sink and sob silently under the strip lighting. There were a few occasions when I thought about what Will still intended to do, where I actually had to fight the urge to scream. I felt overcome by a kind of madness, and thought I might just sit down in the aisle and howl until someone else stepped in, until someone else made sure he couldn't do it. So although I looked childish, although I seemed to the cabin staff as I declined to talk to Will, to look at him, to feed him, as if I were the most heartless of women, I knew that pretending he was not there was about the only way I could cope with these hours of enforced proximity. If I had believed Nathan capable of coping alone, I would honestly have changed my flight, perhaps even disappeared until I could make sure that there was between us a whole continent, not just a few impossible inches. The two men slept, and it came as something of a relief, a brief respite from the tension. I stared at the television screen, and with every mile that we headed towards home, I felt my heart grow heavier, my anxiety greater. It began to occur to me then that my failure was not just my own. Will's parents were going to be devastated. They would probably blame me. Will's sister would probably sue me. And it was my failure for Will, too. I had failed to persuade him. I had offered him everything I could, including myself, and nothing I had shown him had convinced him of a reason to keep living. Perhaps, I found myself thinking, he had deserved someone better than me, someone cleverer. Someone like Trina might have thought of better things to do. They might have found some rare piece of medical research or something that could have helped him. They might have changed his mind. The fact that I was going to have to live with this knowledge for the rest of my life made me feel almost dizzy.
"Want a drink, Clark?"
Will's voice would break into my thoughts. "No, thank you."
"Is my elbow too far over your armrest?"
"No, it's fine." It was only in those last few hours, in the dark, that I allowed myself to look at him, My gaze slid slowly sideways from my glowing television screen until I gazed at him surreptitiously in the dim light of the little cabin. And as I took in his face, so tanned and handsome, so peaceful in sleep, a solitary tear rolled down my cheek. Perhaps some way conscious of my scrutiny, Will stirred, but didn't wake. And unseen by the cabin staff, by Nathan, I pulled his blanket slowly up around his neck, tucking it in carefully, to make sure in the chill of the cabin air conditioning that Will would not feel the cold. They were waiting at the arrivals gate. I had somehow known they would be. I had felt the faintly sick sensation expanding inside me, even as we wheeled Will through passport control, fast-tracked by some well-meaning official, even as I prayed that we would be forced to wait, stuck in a queue that lasted hours, preferably days. But no, we crossed the vast expanse of linoleum, me pushing the baggage trolley, Nathan pushing Will, and as the glass doors opened, there they were, standing at the barrier, side by side in some rare semblance of unity. I saw Mrs. Trainor's face briefly light up as she saw Will, and I thought absently, "Of course, he looks so well." And to my shame, I put on my sunglasses. Not to hide my exhaustion, but so that she wouldn't immediately see from my naked expression what it was I was going to have to tell her.
"Look at you!"
she was exclaiming.
"Will, you look wonderful! Really wonderful!"
Will's father had stooped, was patting his son's chair, his knee, his face wreathed in smiles.
"We couldn't believe it when Nathan told us you were down on the beach every day. And swimming! What was the water like then? Lovely and warm? It's been raining cats and dogs here. Typical August."
Of course. Nathan would have been texting them or calling them, as if they would have let us go all that time without some kind of contact.
It was a pretty amazing place," said Nathan.
He had grown quiet too, but now tried to smile, to seem his normal self. I felt frozen, my hand clutching my passport like I was about to go somewhere else. I had to remind myself to breathe.
"Well, we thought you might like a special dinner,"
Will's father said.
"There's a jolly nice restaurant at the Intercontinental. Champagne on us. What do you think? Your mother and I thought it might be a nice treat."
"Sure," said Will. He was smiling at his mother, and she was looking back at him as if she wanted to bottle it.
"How can you?" I wanted to yell at him. "How can you look at her like that when you already know what you are going to do to her?"
"Come on then. I've got the car in disabled parking. It's only a short ride from here. I was pretty sure you'd all be a bit jet-lagged. Nathan, do you want me to take any of those bags?"
My voice broke into the conversation.
"Actually," I said. I was already pulling my luggage from the trolley. "I think I'm going to head off. Thank you anyway."
I was focused on my bag, deliberately not looking at them. But even above the hubbub of the airport, I could detect the brief silence my words provoked. Mr. Trainor's voice was the first to break it.
"Come on, Louisa. Let's have a little celebration. We want to hear all about your adventures. I want to know all about the island. And I promise you, you don't have to tell us everything."
He almost chuckled.
Yes.
Mrs. Trainer's voice had a faint edge to it. Do come, Louisa.
No.
I swallowed, tried to raise a bland smile. My sunglasses were a shield.
Thank you. I'd really rather get back.
To where?
Said Will. I realized what he was saying. I didn't really have anywhere to go.
I'll go to my parents' house. It will be fine.
Come with us,
he said. His voice was gentle.
Don't go, Clark. Please.
I wanted to cry then, but I knew with utter certainty that I couldn't be anywhere near him.
No, thank you. I hope you have a lovely breakfast.
I hoisted my bag over my shoulder, and before anyone could say anything else, I was walking away from them, swallowed up by the crowds in the terminal. I was almost at the bus stop when I heard her, Camilla Trainer, her heels clipping on the pavement, half walked, half ran towards me.
Stop! Louisa! Please stop!
I turned, and she was forcing her way through a coach party, casting the backpacking teenagers aside like Moses parting the waves. The airport lights were bright on her hair, turning it a kind of copper colour. She was wearing a fine grey pashmina, which draped artistically over one shoulder. I remember thinking absently how beautiful she must have been only a few years earlier.
Please! Please stop!
I stopped, glancing behind me at the road, wishing the bus would appear now, that it would scoop me up and take me away, that anything would happen, a small earthquake, maybe.
Louisa?
He had a good time. My voice sounded clipped, oddly like her own, I found myself thinking.
He does look well, very well.
She stared at me, standing there on the pavement. She was suddenly acutely still, despite the sea of people moving around her. We didn't speak. And then I said,
Mrs. Trainer, I'd like to hand in my notice. I can't do these last few days. I'll forfeit any money owed to me. In fact, I don't want this month's money. I don't want anything. I just...
She went pale then. I saw the colour drain from her face, the way she swayed a little in the morning sunshine. I saw Mr. Trainer coming up behind her, his stride brisk, one hand holding his Panama hat firmly on his head. He was muttering his apologies as he pushed through the crowds, his eyes fixed on me and his wife as we stood rigidly a few feet apart.
You said you thought he was happy. You said you thought this might change his mind.
She sounded desperate, as if she were pleading with me to say something else, to give her some different result. I couldn't speak. I stared at her, and the most I could manage was a small shake of my head.
I'm sorry,
I whispered, so quietly that she could not have heard me. He was almost there as she fell. It was as if her legs just gave way under her, and Mr. Trainer's left arm shot out and caught her as she went down, her mouth a great O, her body slumped against his. His hat fell to the pavement. He glanced up at me, his face confused, not yet registering what had just taken place. And I couldn't look.
I turned numb, and I began to walk, one foot in front of the other, my legs moving almost before I knew what they were doing, away from the airport, not yet even knowing where it was I was going to go. Chapter 25.
Katrina. Louisa didn't come out of her room for a whole 36 hours after she got back from her holiday. She arrived back from the airport late evening on the Sunday, pale as a ghost under her suntan. And we couldn't work that out for a start. She had definitely said she'd see us first thing Monday morning. "I just need to sleep," she had said, then shut herself in her room and gone straight to bed. We had thought it a little odd, but what did we know? Lou has been peculiar since birth, after all. Mum had taken up a mug of tea in the morning, and Lou had not stirred. By supper, Mum had become worried and shaken her, checking she was alive. She can be a bit melodramatic, Mum. Although, to be fair, she had made fish pie, and she probably just wanted to make sure Lou wasn't going to miss it. But Lou wouldn't eat, and she wouldn't talk, and she wouldn't come downstairs. "I just want to stay here for a bit, Mum," she said into her pillow. Finally, Mum left her alone. "She's not herself," said Mum. "Do you think it's some kind of delayed reaction to the thing with Patrick?"
"She couldn't give his stuff about Patrick," Dad said. "I told her he rang to tell us he had come 157th in the Viking thing, and she couldn't have looked less interested." He sipped his tea. "Mind you, to be fair on her, even I found it pretty hard to get excited about 157th.
"Oh, do you think she's ill? She's awful pale under that tan, and all that sleeping, it's just not like her. She might have some terrible tropical disease."
"She's just jet-lagged," I said. I said it with some authority, knowing that Mum and Dad tended to treat me as an expert on all sorts of matters that none of us really knew anything about.
"Jet lag? Well, if that's what long-haul travel does to you, I think I'll stick with Tembi. What do you think, Josie, love?"
"Oh, I don't know. Who would have thought a holiday could make you look so ill?" Mum shook her head.
I went upstairs after supper. I didn't knock. It was still, strictly speaking, my room, after all. The air was thick and stale, and I pulled the blind up and opened a window so that Lou turned groggily from under the duvet, shielding her eyes from the light, dust motes swirling around her. "You going to tell me what happened?" I put a mug of tea on the bedside table. She blinked at me.
"Mum thinks you've got Ebola virus. She's busy warning all the neighbours who have booked onto the bingo club trip to PortAventura."
She didn't say anything. "Lou?" "I quit," she said quietly.
"Why?"
"Why do you think?" She pushed herself upright and reached clumsily for the mug, taking a long sip of tea. For someone who had just spent almost 2 weeks in Mauritius, she looked bloody awful. Her eyes were tiny and red-rimmed, and her skin, without the tan, would have looked even blotchier. Her hair stuck up on one side. She looked like she'd been awake for several years, but most of all she looked sad. I'd never seen my sister look so sad. "You think he's really going to go through with it?" She nodded, then she swallowed hard. "Shit. Oh, Lou, I'm really sorry." I motioned to her to shove over, and I climbed into bed beside her. She took another sip of her tea, and then leant her head on my shoulder. She was wearing my T-shirt. I didn't say anything about it. That was how bad I felt for her.
"What do I do, Trine?" Her voice was small, like Thomas's, when he hurts himself and is trying to be really brave.
Outside, we could hear next door's dog running up and down alongside the garden fence, chasing the neighbourhood cats. Every now and then, we could hear a burst of manic barking. Its head would be popping up over the top right now, its eyes bulging with frustration.
"I'm not sure there's anything you can do." "Oh, God, all that stuff you fixed up for him, all that effort." "I told him I loved him," she said, her voice dropping to a whisper.
and he'd just said it wasn't enough? Her eyes were wide and bleak. How am I supposed to live with that?
I am the one in the family who knows everything. I read more than anyone else, I go to university, I am the one who is supposed to have all the answers. But I looked at my big sister, and I shook my head. I haven't got a clue, I said. She finally emerged the following day, showered and wearing clean clothes, and I told Mum and Dad not to say a word. I implied it was boyfriend trouble, and Dad raised his eyebrows and made a face as if that explained everything, and God only knew what we had been working ourselves into such a fuss over. Mum ran off to ring the bingo club and tell them she'd had second thoughts about the risks of air travel. Lou ate a piece of toast. She didn't want lunch. And she put on a big floppy sun hat, and we walked up to the castle with Thomas to feed the ducks. I don't think she really wanted to go out, but Mum insisted that we all needed some fresh air. This, in my mother's vocabulary, meant she was itching to get into the bedroom and air it and change the bedding. Thomas skipped and hopped ahead of us, clutching a plastic bag full of crusts, and we negotiated the meandering tourists with an ease born of years of practice, ducking out of the way of swinging backpacks, separating around posing couples and rejoining on the other side. The castle baked in the high heat of summer, the ground cracked and the grass wispy, like the last hairs on the head of a balding man. The flowers in the tubs looked defeated, as if they were already half preparing for autumn. Lou and I didn't say much. What was there to say? As we walked past the tourist car park, I saw her glance under her brim at the trainer's house. It stood elegant and red brick, its tall, blank windows disguising whatever life-changing drama was being played out in there, perhaps even at this moment. "You could go and talk to him, you know," I said. "I'll wait here for you." She looked at the ground, folded her arms across her chest, and we kept walking. "There's no point," she said. I knew the other bit, the bit she didn't say aloud. "He's probably not even there." We did a slow circuit of the castle, watching Thomas roll down the steep parts of the hill, feeding the ducks that by this stage in the season were so well stuffed they could barely be bothered to come over for mere bread. I watched my sister as we walked, seeing her brown back exposed by her halter neck top, her stooped shoulders, and I realised that even if she didn't know it yet, everything had changed for her. She wouldn't stay here now, no matter what happened with Will Trainer. She had an air about her, a new air of knowledge, of things seen, places she had been. My sister finally had new horizons. "Oh," I said as we headed back towards the gates, "you got a letter from the college while you were away? Sorry, I opened it. I thought it must be for me." "You opened it?" I had been hoping it was extra grant money. "You got an interview?" She blinked as if receiving news from some long distant past. "Yeah, and the big news is it's tomorrow," I said. "So I thought maybe we should go over some possible questions tonight." She shook her head. "I can't go to an interview tomorrow." "What else are you going to do?" "I can't, Treen," she said sorrowfully. "How am I supposed to think about anything at a time like this?" "Listen, Lou, they don't give interviews out like bread for ducks, you idiot. This is a big deal. They know you're a mature student, you're applying at the wrong time of year, and they're still going to see you. You can't muck them around." "I don't care. I can't think about it." "But you..." "Just leave me alone, Treen, okay? I can't do it." "Hey," I said. I stepped in front of her so that she couldn't keep walking. Thomas was talking to a pigeon a few paces up ahead. "This is exactly the time you have to think about it. This is the time when, like it or not, you finally have to work out what you're going to do with the rest of your life." We were blocking the path. Now the tourists had to separate to walk around us. They did so, heads down, or eyeing with mild curiosity the arguing sisters. "I can't." "Well, tough, because in case you forgot, you have no job anymore. No Patrick to pick up the pieces. And if you miss this interview, then in 2 days' time, you are headed back down the job centre to decide whether you want to be a chicken processor or a lap dancer or wipe some other person's bum for a living. And believe it or not, because you are now headed for 30, that's your life pretty well mapped out. And all of this, everything you've learned over the past 6 months, will have been a waste of time, all of it. She stared at me, wearing that look of mute fury she wears when she knows I am right and she can't say anything back. Thomas appeared beside us now and pulled at my hand.
Mum, you said bum.
My sister was still glaring at me, but I could see her thinking. I turned to my son. No, sweetheart, I said bun. We're going to go home for tea now, aren't we, Lou, and see if we can have some buns. And then, while Granny gives you a bath, I'm going to help Auntie Lou do her homework. I went to the library the next day, and Mum looked after Thomas, so I saw Lou off on the bus and knew I wouldn't see her again till tea time. I didn't hold out a lot of hope for the interview, but from the moment I left her, I didn't actually give her another thought. It might sound a bit selfish, but I don't like getting behind with my coursework, and it was a bit of a relief to have a break from Lou's misery. Being around someone that depressed is a bit of a drain. You might feel sorry for them, but you can't help wanting to tell them to pull themselves together, too. I shoved my family, my sister, the epic mess she had got herself into a mental file, shut the drawer, and focused my attention on VAT exemptions. I got the second highest marks in my year for Accountancy 1, and there was no way on earth I was dropping back just because of the vagaries of HMRC's flat rate system. I got home around 5:45, put my files on the hall chair, and they were all lurking around the kitchen table already while Mum began to serve up. Thomas jumped on me, winding his legs around my waist, and I kissed him, breathing in his lovely, yeasty little boy smell. Sit down, Mum said. Dad's only just in. How'd you get on with your books? Dad said, hanging his jacket on the back of the chair. He always referred to them as my books, like they had a life of their own and had to be wrangled into order. Good, thanks. I'm 3/4 of the way through my Accountancy 2 module, and then tomorrow I'm on corporate law. I peeled Thomas from me and put him down on the chair next to me, one hand resting in his soft hair. Hear that, Josie? Corporate law. Dad stole a potato from the dish and stuffed it into his mouth before Mum could see. He said it like he relished the sound of it. I suppose he probably did. We chatted for a bit about the kinds of things my module involved. Then we talked about Dad's job, mostly about how the tourists broke everything. You wouldn't believe the maintenance, apparently. Even the wooden posts at the car park gateway needed replacing every few weeks because the idiots couldn't drive a car through a 12-foot gap. Personally, I would have put a surcharge on the ticket price to cover it, but that's just me. Mum finished serving up and finally sat down. Thomas ate with his fingers while he thought nobody noticed, and said bum under his breath with a secret smile. And Grandad ate with his gaze tilted upwards, as if he were actually thinking about something else entirely. I glanced over at Lou. She was gazing at her plate, pushing the roast chicken around as if trying to disguise it. Uh-oh, I thought.
You not hungry, love?
Said Mum, following the line of my gaze. Not very, she said.
It is very warm for chicken, Mum conceded. I just thought you needed perking up a bit.
So, you going to tell us how you got on at this interview?
Dad's fork stopped halfway to his mouth. Oh, that. She looked distracted, as if he had just dredged up something she did 5 years ago.
Yes, that.
She speared a tiny piece of chicken. It was okay. Dad glanced at me. I gave a tiny shrug.
Just okay? They must have given you some idea how you did.
I got it.
What?
She was still looking down at her plate. I stopped chewing. They said I was exactly the kind of applicant they were looking for. I've got to do some kind of foundation course, which takes a year, and then I can convert it. Dad sat back in his chair.
Well, that's fantastic news!
Mum reached over and patted her shoulder.
Oh, well done, love, that's brilliant.
Not really. I don't think I can afford 4 years of study.
Oh, don't you worry about that just now, really. Look how well Trina's managing. Hey,
he nudged her,
We'll find a way. We always find a way, don't we?
Dad beamed at us both. I think everything's turning around for us now, girls. I think this is going to be a good time for this family.
And then, out of nowhere, she burst into tears. Real tears. She cried like Thomas cries, wailing, all snot and tears and not caring who hears, her sobs breaking through the silence of the little room like a knife. Thomas stared at her, open-mouthed, so that I had to haul him onto my lap and distract him so that he didn't get upset too. And while I fiddled with bits of potato and talking peas and made silly voices, she told them. She told them everything, about Will and the 6-month contract, and what had happened when they went to Mauritius. As she spoke, Mum's hands went to her mouth. Grandad looked solemn. The chicken grew cold, the gravy congealing in its boat. Dad shook his head in disbelief. And then, as my sister detailed her flight home from the Indian Ocean, her voice dropping to a whisper as she spoke of her last words to Mrs. Traynor, he pushed his chair back and stood up. He walked slowly around the table and he took her in his arms, like he had when we were little. He stood there and held her really, really tightly to him. Oh, Jesus Christ, the poor fella. And poor you, oh, Jesus. I'm not sure I ever saw Dad look so shocked. What a bloody mess. You went through all this without saying anything, and all we got was a postcard about scuba diving. My mother was incredulous. But we thought you were having the holiday of a lifetime. I wasn't alone. Trina knew. She said, looking at me. Trina was great. I didn't do anything, I said, hugging Thomas. He had lost interest in the conversation now that Mum had put an open tin of celebrations in front of him. I was just an ear. You did the lot. You came up with all the ideas. Some ideas they turned out to be. She leant against Dad, sounding bereft. Dad tilted her chin so that she had to look at him. But you did everything you could. And I failed. Who says you failed? Dad stroked her hair back from her face. His face was tender. I'm just thinking of what I know about Will Traynor, what I know about men like him, and I'll say one thing to you. I'm not sure anyone in the world was ever going to persuade that man once he'd set his mind to something. He's who he is. You can't make people change who they are.
But his parents, they can't let him kill himself, said Mum. What kind of people are they?
They're normal people, Mum. Mrs. Traynor just doesn't know what else she can do.
Well, not bloody taking him to this clinic would be a start.
Mum was angry. 2 points of colour had risen to her cheekbones.
I would fight for you two, for Thomas, until my dying breath.
Even if he'd already tried to kill himself, I said, in really grim ways.
He's ill, Katrina. He's depressed. People who are vulnerable should not be given the chance to do something that they'll...
She tailed off in mute fury and dabbed at her eyes with a napkin.
That woman must be heartless, heartless. And to think they got Louisa involved in all this. She's a magistrate, for goodness sake. You'd think a magistrate would know what was right or wrong. Of all people, I've a good mind to head down there now and bring him back here.
It's complicated, Mum.
No, it's not. He's vulnerable, and there is no way on earth she should entertain the thought of it. I'm shocked, that poor man, that poor man.
She got up from the table, taking the remains of the chicken with her, and stalked out to the kitchen. Louisa watched her go, her expression a little stunned. Mum was never angry. I think the last time we heard her raise a voice was 1993. Dad shook his head, his mind apparently elsewhere.
I've just thought, no wonder I hadn't seen Mr. Traynor. I wondered where he was. I assumed they were all off on some family holiday.
They've gone.
Well, he's not been in these last 2 days.
Lou sat back down and slumped in her chair.
Oh, shit, I said, and then clamped my hands around Thomas's ears.
It's tomorrow.
Lou looked at me and I glanced up at the calendar on the wall. The 13th of August, it's tomorrow. Lou did nothing that last day. She was up before me, staring out of the kitchen window. It rained and then it cleared, and then it rained again. She lay on the sofa with Grandad, and she drank the tea that Mum made her, and every half an hour or so I watched her gaze slide silently towards the mantelpiece and check the clock. It was awful to watch. I took Thomas swimming and I tried to make her come with us. I said Mum would mind him if she wanted to go to the shops with me later. I said I'd take her to the pub, just the two of us, but she refused every offer. "What if I made a mistake, Katrine?" she said, so quietly that only I could hear it. I glanced up at Grandad, but he had eyes only for the racing. I think Dad was still putting on a sneaky bet each way for him, even though he denied it to Mum. "What do you mean? What if I should have gone with him? But you said you couldn't." Outside, the skies were grey. She stared through our immaculate windows at the miserable day beyond. "I know what I said, but I just can't bear not knowing what's happening." Her face crumpled a little. "I can't bear not knowing how he's feeling. I can't bear the fact that I never even got to say goodbye. Couldn't you go now? Maybe try and get a flight?" "It's too late," she said. And then she closed her eyes. "I never get there in time. There's only 2 hours left until it stops for the day. I looked it up on the internet." I waited. "They don't do it after 5:30. She shook her head in bemusement. "Something to do with the Swiss officials who have to be there. They don't like certifying things outside office hours." I almost laughed. I didn't know what to say to her. I couldn't imagine having to wait as she was waiting, knowing what might be happening in some far-off place. I had never loved a man like she seemed to love Will. I had liked men, sure, and wanted to sleep with them, but sometimes I wondered if I was missing some sensitivity chip. I couldn't imagine crying over anyone I'd been with. The only equivalent was if I thought about Thomas waiting to die in some strange country, and as soon as that thought came to mind, it made something inside me actually flip over. It was so hideous. So I stuck that in the back of my mental filing cabinet too, under the drawer labelled Unthinkable. I sat down beside my sister on the sofa, and we stared in silence at the 3:30 maiden stakes, then the 4 o'clock handicap stakes, and the 4 races that followed it, with the fixed intensity of people who might actually have all the money in the world on the winner. And then the doorbell rang. Louisa was off the sofa and in the hallway in seconds. She opened the door, and the way she wrenched it open made even my heart stop. But it wasn't Will there on the doorstep. It was a young woman, her makeup thick and perfectly applied, her hair cut in a neat bob around her chin. She folded her umbrella and smiled, reaching round towards the large bag she had over her shoulder. I wondered briefly if this was Will Traynor's sister.
"Louisa Clark?"
"Yes,
I'm from the Globe. I wondered if I could have a quick word."
The Globe?" I could hear the confusion in Lou's voice.
"The newspaper?" I stepped behind my sister. I saw then the notepad in the woman's hand. "Can I come in? I'd just like to have a little chat with you about William Traynor. You do work for William Traynor, don't you?"
"No comment," I said, and before the woman had a chance to say anything else, I slammed the door in her face. My sister stood stunned in the hallway. She flinched as the doorbell rang again.
"Don't answer it," I hissed.
"But how..." I began to push her up the stairs. God, she was impossibly slow. It was like she was half asleep.
"Grandad, don't answer the door," I yelled. "Who have you told?" I said when we reached the landing. "Someone must have told them. Who knows?"
Miss Clark,
The woman's voice came through the letterbox. If you just give me 10 minutes, we do understand this is a very sensitive issue. We'd like you to put your side of the story.
What does this mean, he's dead?
Her eyes had filled with tears. No, it just means some arse is trying to cash in, I thought for a minute. Who was that, girls? Mum's voice came up the stairwell. No one, Mum. Just don't answer the door. I peered over the banister. Mum was holding a tea towel in her hands and gazing at the shadowy figure visible through the glass panels of the front door.
Don't answer the door?
I took my sister's elbow. Lou, you didn't say anything to Patrick, did you? She didn't need to say anything. Her stricken face said it all. Okay, don't have a baby. Just don't go near the door. Don't answer the phone. Don't say a word to them, okay? Mum was not amused. She was even less amused after the phone started ringing. After the fifth call, we put all calls through to the answer phone, but we still had to listen to them, their voices invading our little hallway. There were 4 or 5 of them, all the same, all offering Lou the chance to put her side of the story, as they called it. Like Will Traynor was now some commodity that they were all scrabbling over. The telephone rang, and the doorbell rang. We sat with the curtains closed, listening to the reporters on the pavement just outside our gate, chatting to each other and speaking on their mobile phones. It was like being under siege. Mum wrung her hands and shouted through the letterbox for them to get the hell out of our front garden whenever one of them ventured past the gate. Thomas gazed out of the upstairs bathroom window and wanted to know why there were people in our garden. 4 of our neighbours rang, wanting to know what was going on. Dad parked in Ivy Street and came home via the back garden, and we had a fairly serious talk about castles and boiling oil. Then, after I'd thought a bit longer, I rang Patrick and asked him how much he had got for his sordid little tip. The slight delay before he denied everything told me all I needed to know. "You shitbag," I yelled. "I'm going to kick your stupid marathon-running shin so hard you're going to think 157th was actually a good result." Lou just sat in the kitchen and cried. Not proper sobbing. Just silent tears that ran down her face, and which she wiped away with the palm of her hand. I couldn't think what to say to her. Which was fine. I had plenty to say to everyone else. All but one of the reporters cleared off by 7:30. I didn't know if they had given up, or if Thomas's habit of posting bits of Lego out of the letterbox every time they passed another note through had become boring. I told Louisa to bath Thomas for me, mainly because I wanted her to get out of the kitchen, but also because that way I could go through all the messages on our answer phone and delete the newspaper ones while she couldn't hear me. 26 of the buggers, and all sounding so nice, so understanding. Some of them even offered her money. I pressed delete on everyone. Even those offering money, although I admit I was a teeny bit tempted to see how much they were offering. All the while I heard Lou talking to Thomas in the bathroom, the whine and splash of him dive-bombing his 6 inches of soap suds with the Batmobile. That's the thing you don't know about children unless you have them. Bath time, Lego and fish fingers don't allow you to dwell on tragedy for too long. And then I hit the last message. "Louisa, it's Camilla Traynor. Will you call me as soon as possible?" I stared at the answer phone. I rewound and replayed it. Then I ran upstairs and whipped Thomas out of the bath so fast my boy didn't even know what hit him. He was standing there, the towel wrapped tightly around him like a compression bandage, and Lou, stumbling and confused, was already halfway down the stairs, me pushing her by the shoulder. "What if she hates me?" "She didn't sound like she hated you." "But what if the press are surrounding them there? What if they think it's all my fault?" Her eyes were wide and terrified. "What if she's ringing to tell me he's done it?" "Oh, for Christ's sake, Lou, for once in your life, just get a grip. You won't know anything unless you call. Call her, just call. You don't have a bloody choice." I ran back into the bathroom to set Thomas free. I shoved him into his pyjamas, told him that Granny had a biscuit for him if he ran to the kitchen super fast, and then I peered out of the bathroom door to peek at my sister on the phone down in the hallway. She was turned away from me, one hand smoothing the hair at the back of her head. She reached out a hand to steady herself. "Yes," she was saying, "I see." And then, "Okay." And after a pause, "Yes." She looked down at her feet for a good minute after she'd put the phone down. "Well," I said. She looked up as if she'd only just seen me there and shook her head. "It was nothing about the newspapers," she said, her voice still numb with shock. "She asked me, begged me, to come to Switzerland. And she's booked me onto the last flight out this evening."
T6. In other circumstances, I suppose it might have seemed strange that I, Lou Clark, a girl who had rarely been more than a bus ride from her hometown in 20 years, was now flying to her third country in less than a week. But I packed an overnight case with the swift efficiency of an air stewardess, rejecting all but the barest necessities. Trina ran around silently fetching any other things she thought I might need, and then we headed downstairs. We stopped halfway down. Mum and Dad were already in the hall, standing side by side in the ominous way they used to do when we sneaked back late from a night out. "What's going on?" Mum was staring at my case. Trina had stopped in front of me.
"Lou's going to Switzerland," she said. "And she needs to leave now. There's only one flight left today."
We were about to move when Mum stepped forward. "No." Her mouth was set into an unfamiliar line, her arms folded awkwardly in front of her. "Really, I don't want you involved. If this is what I think it is, then no."
"But,"
Trina began, glancing behind at me.
"No,"
said Mum, and her voice held an unusually steely quality.
"No buts. I've been thinking about this, about everything you told us. It's wrong, morally wrong. And if you get embroiled in it, and you're seen to be helping a man kill himself, then you could end up in all sorts of trouble."
"Your mum's right," Dad said. "We've seen it in the news. This could affect your whole life, Lou. This college interview, everything. If you get a criminal record, you will never get a college degree or a good job or anything."
"He's asked for her to come. She can't just ignore him," Trina interrupted.
"Yes, yes she can. She's given 6 months of her life to this family, and a fat lot of good it's brought her, judging by the state of things. A fat lot of good it's brought this family, with people banging on the door and all the neighbours thinking we've been done for benefit fraud or some such. No, she's finally got the chance to make something of herself, and now they want her to go to that dreadful place in Switzerland and get involved in God knows what. Well, I say no, no, Louisa."
"But she has to go," Trina said.
"No, she doesn't. She's done enough. She said herself last night she's done everything she could."
Mum shook her head.
"Whatever mess the trainers are going to make of their lives, going to whatever they're going to do to their own son, I don't want Louisa involved. I don't want her ruining her whole life."
"I think I can make my own mind up," I said.
"I'm not sure you can. This is your friend, Louisa. This is a young man with his whole life ahead of him. You cannot be part of this. I'm shocked that you could even consider it."
Mum's voice had a new hard edge.
I didn't bring you up to help someone end his life. Would you end Grandad's life? Do you think we should shove him off to Dignitas too? Grandad is different. No, he isn't. He can't do what he used to, but his life is precious, just as Will's is precious. It's not my decision, Mum. It's Will's. The whole point of this is to support Will. Support Will? I've never heard such rubbish. You were a child, Louisa. You've seen nothing, done nothing, and you have no idea what this is going to do to you. How in God's name will you ever be able to sleep at night if you help him to go through with it? You'd be helping a man to die. Do you really understand that? You'd be helping Will, that lovely, clever young man, to die. I'd sleep at night because I trust Will to know what is right for him, and because what has been the worst thing for him has been losing the ability to make a single decision, to do a single thing for himself. I looked at my parents, trying to make them understand. I'm not a child. I love him. I love him. And I shouldn't have left him alone. And I can't bear not being there and not knowing what he's... I swallowed. So yes, I'm going. I don't need you to look out for me or understand. I'll deal with it. But I'm going to Switzerland, whatever either of you says. The little hallway grew silent. Mum stared at me like she had no idea who I was. I took a step closer to her, trying to make her understand. But as I did, she took a step back. Mum, I owe Will. I owe it to him to go. Who do you think got me to apply to college? Who do you think encouraged me to make something of myself, to travel places, to have ambitions? Who changed the way I think about everything, about myself even? Will did. I've done more, lived more in the last 6 months than in the last 27 years of my life. So if he wants me to go to Switzerland, then yes, I'm going to go, whatever the outcome. There was a brief silence.
She's like Aunt Lily,
Dad said quietly. We all stood, staring at each other. Dad and Trina were shooting glances at each other, as if each of them were waiting for the other to say something. But Mum broke the silence. If you go, Louisa, you needn't come back. The words fell out of her mouth like pebbles. I looked at my mother in shock. Her gaze was unyielding. It tensed as she watched for my reaction. It was as if a wall I had never known was there had sprung up between us.
Mum?
I mean it. This is no better than murder. Josie! That's the truth, Bernard. I can't be part of this. I remember thinking, as if at a distance, that I had never seen Katrina look so uncertain as she did now. I saw Dad's hand reach out to Mum's arm, whether in reproach or comfort, I couldn't tell. My mind went briefly blank. Then, almost without knowing what I was doing, I walked slowly down the stairs and past my parents to the front door. And after a second, my sister followed me. The corners of Dad's mouth turned down, as if he were struggling to contain all sorts of things. Then he turned to Mum and placed one hand on her shoulder. Her eyes searched his face, and it was as if she already knew what he was going to say. And then he threw Trina his keys. She caught them one-handed.
Here, he said. Go out the back door, through Mrs. Doherty's garden and take the van. They won't see you in the van. If you go now and the traffic's not too bad, you might just make it.
You have any idea where this is all headed? Katrina said. She glanced sideways at me as we sped down the motorway. Nope. I couldn't look at her for long. I was rifling through my handbag, trying to work out what I had forgotten. I kept hearing the sound of Mrs. Trainer's voice down the line. Louisa? Please will you come? I know we've had our differences, but please, it's vital that you come now.
Shit, I've never seen Mum like that, Trina continued. Passport, wallet, door keys.
Door keys? For what? I no longer had a home.
Katrina glanced sideways at me. I mean, she's mad now, but she's in shock. You know she'll be all right in the end, right? I mean, when I came home and told her I was up the duff, I thought she was never going to speak to me again. But it only took her, what, 2 days to come round? I could hear her babbling away beside me, but I wasn't really paying attention. I could barely focus on anything. My nerve endings seemed to have come alive. They almost jangled with anticipation. I was going to see Will. Whatever else, I had that. I could almost feel the miles between us shrinking, as if we were at two ends of some invisible elastic thread. Trine. Yes? I swallowed. Don't let me miss this flight. My sister is nothing if not determined. We queue-jumped, sped up the inside lane, broke the speed limit, and scanned the radio for the traffic reports. And finally, the airport came into view. She screeched to a halt, and I was halfway out of the car before I heard her.
Hey! Lou! Sorry.
I turned back and ran the few steps to her. She hugged me, really tightly.
You're doing the right thing, she said. She looked almost close to tears. Now fuck off. If you miss the bloody plane on top of me getting 6 points on my license, I'm never talking to you again.
I didn't look back. I ran all the way to the Swiss Air desk, and it took me 3 goes to say my name clearly enough to request my tickets. I arrived in Zurich shortly before midnight. Given the late hour, Mrs. Trainer had, as promised, booked me into a hotel at the airport and said she would send a car for me at 9 the following morning. I had thought I wouldn't sleep. But I did. An odd, heavy and disjointed trawl through the hours, waking up at 7 the next morning with no idea where I was. I stared groggily around the unfamiliar room, at the heavy burgundy drapes designed to block out light, at the large flat-screen television, at my overnight bag, which I hadn't even bothered to unpack. I checked the clock, which said it was shortly after 7 Swiss time. And as I realised where I was, I suddenly felt my stomach clench with fear. I scrambled out of bed just in time to be sick in the little bathroom. I sank down on the tiled floor, my hair sticking to my forehead, my cheek pressed against the cold porcelain. I heard my mother's voice, her protests, and I felt a dark fear creeping over me. I wasn't up to this. I didn't want to fail again. I didn't want to have to watch Will die. With an audible groan, I scrambled up to be sick again.
I couldn't eat. I managed to swallow down a cup of black coffee and showered and dressed, and that took me to 8 a.m. I stared at the pale green dress I had thrown in last night and wondered